But before I do, anything anybody want to say left over from last week or having occurred to you subsequently, questions, assertions, comments? All right, so one of the fundamental hypotheses of this course and its companion in the fall, the Law and the Internet Society course, of the way I work in this area where I also practice as well as yammering on in the classroom from week to week, one of the fundamental premises of all of this for me is that in order to understand the issues we're discussing, questions of law in networked society, there are three required elements in every analysis, every question that we come to, we have to think about in terms of technology and law and politics. Three legs on a stool. We can't stand on them to make any analysis of anything unless we have considered both all of the angles, technology and law and politics. And of course, I have for all these weeks been talking mostly about law in the form of constitutional provisions and politics in the form of political and constitutional history. What I haven't been mostly doing is talking about technology directly. In other words, what I haven't done is to say, here are the technological phenomena upon which our analysis of these legal and historical subjects depend. In particular, of course, the subject here is rights. The ability of individuals and groups of people to enforce against government limitations of government power in a technological environment which maximizes power, not necessarily governmental power, but power over human beings. Because the network we made has developed into a system of extraordinary social control. So the underlying premises that I want to use upon which to make arguments about rights in the networked society of the present and future, the arguments I want to make about that are, of course, arguments also about technology as well as law and politics, and I haven't made technological arguments. I want to today. I want to talk this time and probably next week as well, though again in a slightly different fashion. I want to talk about what the real technological forces and limitations are which deal directly with the question of rights against the state, both rights of expression and also rights of privacy, that is to say, the avoidance of surveillance. I have, of course, both in this course and in its predecessor, spent various kinds of time on technological questions, but I realize in reading your drafts that one coherent form of argument on the subject needs to be presented and will help you in writing what you want to write and in revising what you've written. I also want to state a second premise before I actually start talking about nuts and bolts, and I mean nuts and bolts. The second premise is the premise which sustains ideologically my work. Over the last four decades, that work, whether I was making computer software or I was teaching in law school or I was working as a lawyer in this industry or around this industry, there is a fundamental premise that has been part of what I was doing, and I need to share it explicitly so that I can talk about it explicitly. The premise, I think you have heard it before, is this: freedom begins by knowing that another future is possible. That's a political statement. It's also, from my point of view, a technological statement. My experience with computers, which began when I was 11 3/4 years old or something, more than a half a century ago. My experience with computers came to center on the question, how do computers and people think together, given that computers and human beings don't think alike at all? Those of you who have had technical backgrounds have, of course, spent a fair amount of your life as a technical person dealing with the fact that computers and human beings don't think alike. Human beings have been under the impression all the way along that when they made thinking machines, they made machines in their own image, that the machines we made thought like us. This is a remarkably difficult habit to break, even for people who spend a lot of time with machines. The idea that our way of thinking was reproduced by us in the engineering of thinking machines we made is a powerful human illusion, but it isn't true. For example, and it's an example only, but of some larger utility. For example, machines and humans do not think about numbers in the same way. Plato is, in one sense, correct. I always find myself a little uneasy when I say that, but Plato is, in one sense, correct, that there is an abstract idea of number in the human mind. We can conceive of two-ness, or three-ness. But no machine works that way. When a machine wants to know whether a number is equal to two, it does what only Nelson Goodman has ever considered in the whole history of the human race as the way human beings think. The machine that wants to know whether something is equal to two constructs an instance of two and compares the thing to it to find out whether it is two. There is no idea of two-ness in the computer mind. It is a fully nominalist intelligence in the sense that Nelson Goodman would have constructed nominalism. There's no abstract ideas, there's only instances. This actually makes doing arithmetic with computers hard. I mean arithmetic that human beings are going to recognize. You are aware, for example, that in the decimal system in which you do your arithmetic, a third, one-third, is a repeating fraction, 0.333333333, carried out as far as you want, but continuing and never terminating. It also will have occurred to you at some point, if you've spent any time with machines at the level of the machines themselves, that they think in binary. And that in binary, one-tenth is a repeating fraction. That means that in the world of the computers that we build, digital computers, which do their arithmetic in the end in binary, 10 times 0.1 isn't exactly 1, in the same way that 3 times one-third, 0.33333, isn't exactly 1 because it's really 0.9999999. Just at this level, dealing with machines that have no idea of abstract number but only instances of number, and in which differences in number systems mean that you have to be correcting back and forth all the time. If you want to be mathematically rigorous about it, you have to be constantly adapting to the difference between the uncertainties of binary calculation and the intuitions of decimal calculation in human beings. You are constantly at every stage in regulating relationship of thought between persons and machines, adapting to the fact that they do not think alike in fundamental ways. This, I should point out, is why people who had the particular technical education and life that I had are not believers in even the idea, let alone the reality, of artificial intelligence. To people who came to all of this the way I did, through the last 50 years of computing, the idea of artificial intelligence is inherently absurd. And And everything that we presently call artificial intelligence isn't even artificial intelligence to those who don't think it's absurd, let alone to those of us who do. The metaphors are so far out of relationship to technical realities that every time we discuss in human language, we have to correct for everything about it which is just not quite right. And that's always true in the relationship between humans and machines, which is why, as a technical person, though I'm talking now about my 17-year-old self, as a technical person, my interest was in languages of discussion, programming languages, the languages that human beings use to communicate with both computers and other human beings to describe what goes on. And my life as a technical person, as a young person, putting myself through various other kinds of school that had nothing to do with computers, like history, PhD in law school, and stuff like that, my role as a specialist was to specialize in the development of computer programming languages, the goal of which was to get people and machines to think better, still differently, but to be more effective at communicating with one another by leaving out as much of the difficulty of difference as possible and by making languages which allowed human beings and machines to look at problems in similar ways even though they think dissimilarly. Even there then, all of that was by way of saying, even there then my conception of what it was that I was doing as a thinking person, what it was that my skill was providing alternate futures in which we might think better with machines and be freer as human beings. That was the goal then, and it remained the goal all the way along. In 1979, when I was pushing 20, and I was working at IBM on computer programming language design, I got an assignment to review a computer which was newly made by the not quite yet king, let us call him the Duke of York of the undead, his first effort at a computer that later became the Macintosh called the Lisa. The coolest place of all to work, in my judgment, in 1978 or 1979 was the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. The park was the place where a whole bunch of fundamental conceptions about the relation between computers and human beings were being worked out in the late 1970s. Stuff that you are now rather familiar with, the square display and the two-dimensional click and punch and drag, using a pointing device called a mouse. All that stuff was being worked out at Park, and it all looked very cool. And as I say, if you were interested in the kinds of things you wanted to work, I wanted to work on, Park felt like the very best place to work, and I couldn't get a job there, and instead I wound up working at IBM. And somebody at IBM said, here's this Lisa thing. Tell us what it is. The Lisa was Steve's first effort, as I say, to make use of Park technology. In the end, of course, both the Windows franchise and the Mac franchise were built on versions of the Park ideas, or at least some of them. But the Lisa was his first attempt. And it contained all of the various stuff that marked the craziness of the king of the undead, now dead. Brilliant artistry and some just basic weird things like the one-button mouse and the no fans in computers stuff. The fan noise offended the OCD of the king of the undead, now dead, you understand. Apple computers had to be built as air-cooled devices for almost 20 years because the sound of the fan inflamed the OCD of the king of the undead, now dead. So the Lisa was an early example of a device of his, taking advantage of the Park ideas about how user interfaces should work. And I was asked, so write an appreciation of this. And I said, yeah, this is the thing that destroys everything I want to do. This was the summer of 79, maybe the late fall. And I am looking at the King of the Undead, now Dead's extraordinary and horrifying work for the first time, as in being inside the thing. And I say, yeah, this is what destroys everything I want to do. This is the caveman interface. You point and you grunt. It's a fundamental infantilization of the relationship between human beings and machines. Machines display menus. What do you want to do? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, grunt. And you point and you grunt. The one-button pointing device was an example of the King of the Undead, Now Dead's desire to infantilize the human race. You can't even grunt in two tones. Like short rising grunt, long falling grunt. You can't do any of that. All you can do is grunt. You have one button, and you point somewhere in a two-dimensional field, and you say, And to me, this is my 20-year-old self. This is an example of the way in which machinery can produce slavery. This is an example of the reduction of the human being to a component in the computer machine system. Right? In that sense, even as a technical matter, before we come to law, before we come to politics, before we come to structures of power embedded in the net, two things are already true. Right? There's a way of reducing the person to the level of the machine, and there's a political aspiration to prevent that from becoming a principle of power in the world. And if you know that there's an alternative to that, then you can have a freedom that otherwise the engineering of machine and human being will converge towards removing from you. This is not yet a question of surveillance. This is not yet a question of who holds the data. This is not yet a question of how does the net work. This is simply a consequence of the way in which we adapt either the human intelligence to the machine or the machine to human intelligence. And so all the way along, from my point of view, at every level, fractally, whether we are talking about constitutional law or the decline of law school or the history of the human race, or we're just talking about how computers work, an underlying premise has been that freedom begins by knowing that another future is possible. And technical and aesthetic design are as much a part of that as the larger ultimate political truths about whether we can have a free society without somehow constraining the technology around which and within which we live. All right, all of that is now premise. Preface to my argument concluded, right? You should expect me, therefore, to be saying two things. First of all, technological details have determined, not in a deterministic way, just path dependency, technological details have determined how the computers around you work. Those technical details were always subject to criticism, but you have entered into a world in which those criticisms fell silent. And everything works in a certain way, and it is adapted to changing your mind rather than changing how it works. All of that occurs before we even get to the question of how the net as a whole is organized. So let us now begin two exercises, one of which is technical in a descriptive sense. We assess how the technology around you affects your rights and your freedoms specifically. Second, technical in a normative sense, we assess what it would take to change the relationship that you have to power through the devices and services that you use and consume. We actually try and imagine what is the alternative. And I mean that now, not in broad general terms, but with respect to objects and bits. A technical, not a legal or a political view of what it is that sustains or threatens your freedoms. Of course, I am now tediously going to begin with the smartphone, but trust me, even though it will sound like me ragging on smartphones as usual, I mean to do something else with it. So let's begin then with the way in which the technology that has developed over the past 50 years now conditions the way you think and live and work. To begin with, there are two devices. Because you are educated people engaged in learning, you still have a laptop. But the primary device, the one you share with almost all the human beings around you, is the phone, so-called. A form of computing endpoint device. Let us think a little bit about the nature of this network that we live in. There are now billions of endpoint devices of uncertain design. You are accustomed to two of those form factors, the laptop and the phone. And they are joined to network intermediaries, telcos, and other providers of connectivity. The other providers are important to you because, again, you're educated people in universities, and you are connected to networks that are run not merely for profit by telecommunications intermediary providers, but also for purposes of learning by universities. And they may actually provide you with network service not only where you work, but where you live, because we are all linked in residential networks. These providers of connectivity are linked to storage units, which collectively we have come to call the cloud, although we shouldn't do that just yet. We'll get there in a moment. And these storage units are places in which we agree to have important information kept for two reasons, one of which you call convenience, which is that you can get to that information from different endpoint devices and from different physical locations, and the second, that oddly enough you call safety or security or integrity, most of which means that if devices get destroyed, if endpoints are lost, the information will remain available and you won't lose it all. That we might call the simple service backup, right? Making information harder to destroy. And that's sold to you as safety and security, although it grossly decreases your safety and security in other contexts. But it provides some help against loss or accidental destruction. And these, of course, turn out now to be storage intermediaries whose most important feature is that they also surveil you and analyze you and process behavior information collected about you in return for the provision of storage. Out there also now are states who take advantage of their ability to interact coercively or purposively, from their point of view, with both the providers of connectivity and the providers of storage. They have long and a traditional history stretching back more than 100 years with the providers of connectivity, the telecommunications intermediaries, many of which they owned outright during the course of the 20th century. And they have powerful and complex and largely, from your point of view, invisible relationships with the storage intermediaries. Just a moment more, then, on these endpoints. I have said this before, so you're accustomed to it, and maybe you've already learned to dissociate it a little bit. But the intermediary, the endpoints that are most familiar to you, the ones that are most broadly spread through the human race, are really quite distinctive in the history of computing because they're extraordinarily overstocked with sensors. Gram for gram, those smartphones in your pockets are the densest collection of sensors ever assembled by human technology. We make spy satellites in orbit around the Earth, which are more intensively sensored, more sensor equipped than the phone in your pocket, but they weigh a ton more. And if you look at the sensory capacity per gram, the smartphone is far and away the densest collection of spying equipment that we ever assembled, and it's pointed at you. The amount of power that those sensors consume is so extraordinary that the lithium-ion battery in your smartphone, gram for gram, stores more power than a nuclear power plant produces. Nuclear power plants produce a lot more power, but they weigh a lot. The battery in the phone is a denser collection of electrons for use in electrical current manipulation by devices than a nuclear power plant would be, because the sensors are so overwhelmingly expensive, because running them all the time and pushing them out through radio frequencies as differential as Wi-Fi and proprietary cell network and Bluetooth is an extraordinary lift. Which is why objects like these can burn up and explode, right? Because they actually have extraordinarily dense power supplies in them, and if you short them, they blow up. Those are the devices that you think of as the default computer, the one that's most likely to be used, the one that is most prominent in everybody's daily life, the individual human being. Those are the computers. Extraordinarily dense collections of sensors directed at you, powered by levels of power which are dangerous to have, and all of that functioning in order to push out here not merely the information you regard as important, your email, your calendar, your music collection, not merely that, but everything that everybody else considers to be important. Which is, for example, your pulse rate, and your speed of movement, and your diurnal rhythms, and your physical and sexual and other hungers, and all that stuff. Very important to other people. Infinitely profitable to other people. Nothing that you have any intention of making as important as they are making it, and all of it being used to pay for so-called free services being offered over here on the basis of all that behavioral information about you being collected over there. That's the basic system in which your computing is embedded, in which your digital life is lived. Questions? All of this is dirt familiar to you by now. Yeah.
So, what was it like then prior to cloud technology?
Oh, you want to go only back to last Wednesday. Why not back to the beginning of the thing? After all, the answer to your question depends upon movements across multiple axes. First of all, who has computers? Any computers, right? As I pointed out here at the beginning, the crucial date is in August 1946, when the first non-military digital computer for civilian purposes was delivered to the National Bureau of Standards in suburban Washington. Right? So that's the nanosecond after the Big Bang, right? There's one computer. So we have two orders of magnitude more by 1955. There are hundreds of computers, not military ones, in the United States, almost entire. They are concentrated in the places that you would expect them to be concentrated, in knowledge production and advanced manufacturing. And by 1961, when the United States Pentagon is trying to figure out how to de-skill programming for the first time, because there are thousands of computers in banks and utilities and universities, and the desire is now to make computer programmers not powerful. Here is one of the first ways in which computer language development interacts with the idea of human freedom. The goal is to keep the computer programmers from being too important, which means we need to de-skill computer programming, which means we need to be able to talk to computers in ways that will not require so much skill that the programmers will run everything. What we need, for example, in the view of the Pentagon, is a thing called a common business-oriented language, some way to talk to computers on behalf of electric utilities and department stores and manufacturers and shippers of stuff that won't require so much engineering skill that programmers will be able to command vast wages. That resulted in the design and implementation of a common business-oriented language called COBOL, in which everything was supposed to be written thereafter to run businesses and by people who were not too advanced, right? And COBOL spells everything out in English, the one true human language, and it says, in words spelled out, multiply, price, times, quantity, giving, expansion, period. If you didn't put the period at the end, it wasn't a valid COBOL sentence, right? The goal was to make computing possible to do at a commodity level by making programmers not so clever that you had to pay them a ton and there would only be a few in the world. And so when I was a kid, the newspaper want ads, there were a thing called newspapers, they had things called want ads. You see how difficult it is to answer these questions. And I have to tell you about the entire Pleistocene in order to make this work. There were big, long columns of advertisements in the newspapers for COBOL programmers, right? Because the goal was to commoditize the intelligence. And needless to say, I wasn't the guy who was interested in inventing things like COBOL. The question was, how could you make human beings much smarter in their relation to computers? Not how could you dumb down computer programming such that you could have a much larger and less well-paid workforce? These computers, after all, sit inside people's businesses, what you call premises. Of course, that's the only way you can do it. You have great big machines. They cost tons of money. IBM mainframes cost hundreds of thousands and then millions of dollars. And therefore, where computers are is a really important part of how they exist. All right? The computer of the 1960s and the computer of the 1970s are larger and smaller versions of the same thing, the mainframe and the mini computer, and their job is to sit within businesses and other functioning organizations and to process that organization's data. Storage? See, one of the things that we need to grasp in the process of this is how good the hardware engineers are and how bad software is. I don't know how to explain in any terms that can really render it tangible for you how differentially the two classes of skill have performed over the past 50 years. Just to give an example is already to leap into the middle, but let me give one. In July of 1979, when I couldn't get a job at Park and I went to work at the Santa Teresa Laboratory of IBM, where IBM built mainframe software for the high end of the product line, when I pulled into the parking lot, On the 7th of July, 1979, the Santa Teresa lab, where we made all this mainframe software, was one of the 12 largest data centers inside IBM and one of the 100 largest collections of computers in the world. And I have a spec sheet from the lab on the day I joined, part of the bump I was given, which tells, among other fascinatingly amazing stories, about how many computers we have at the lab and how much power is in there. It tells us how much disk storage we had, direct access storage, DAS. Right? And on the day I joined, this immense data center, acres of stuff under the ground, just hectares of disks, just drives, one after the other, half the size of a refrigerator, 3330s, with spinning platters you could lift out at the end of your arm. All the DAS in the laboratory on the day I joined is 29 gigabytes. An outstanding amount, just unbelievable that we had so much disk drive and so much machinery down there under the ground, under those concrete floors. 29 gigabytes. Okay, now you understand, of course, that 29 gigabytes is at the moment half the size of your thumbnail and can be bought for $9.70. Right. You have to imagine that the hardware engineers have achieved that kind of progress year after year, decade after decade, for half a century. We now possess stuff that costs nothing, and trust me, I really mean nothing. We now possess stuff that costs nothing, which is rocket ships by those days' standards, running on pico or even nanowatts of power, sitting in the palm of your hand, flying saucers that do 99% of the speed of light on apparently no input, just inexhaustible amounts of hardware excellence. Software is arguably worse than it was 50 years ago. The ability to build objects with levels of clout, sizes and speeds and levels of power unimaginable to us all the way through this process, constrained by pretty much the same ideas about how human beings and computers should communicate with one another, deprecated by mass commoditization and fancier, shiny things, thinner and lighter and smaller and brighter to look at movies at. And oh, there's blue background and white text in the SMS application. And it's all crap. So the first thing I have to say to you is, from one set of points of view about what happened, hardware proliferated and became just unimaginably good, and software stagnated. And to the extent that it advanced, what it advanced in doing was spying on users and keeping track of them, a job which we didn't think software should be allowed to do at all. But some fundamental things happened. My comrades and I, who started the 1980s, the era of the personal computer, when it all changed, right? When everything went everywhere and all that excellent hardware stopped being in multi-million dollar collections that belong to businesses and governments, we made personal computers. We brought all of that hardware and what we knew about software and we put it inside people's workspaces. Desktops, then laptops, then notebooks, then tablets. So we proliferated endpoints everywhere and we turned computing into not merely processing information, but watching movies and listening to music and expressing ourselves to one another in the street using short words and bad grammar and lousy language and lots of aggression. All kinds of stuff became computing. But to a first approximation, the ways that we communicated with one another didn't change much. And the ways in which they did are the ones we now need to concentrate on. So the first thing that happened was my comrades and I, who wanted to use all this to create political liberation, faced a little problem. The only thing we needed to do in order to do that was first we needed to change the world software industry. And we did that. That was easy, comparatively speaking. Why was it easy? Well, because intellectual property is shit. Because rules of the ownership of ideas are stupid and controlling, and they deprive people of the freedom to think, and they deprive people of the freedom to invent. And we said all that. And we said we shouldn't make software like that. We should make software by sharing. People shouldn't own software ideas. They should have the ability to use and rethink and remake and reshare those ideas the way we did with science for the last 300 years, which worked out very well for the human race. So the first thing that happened was that the people who wanted software not to be property but to be shared and scientific and useful general information available to all to own, to use, to copy, to modify, to tinker with, and to share, went up against the idea that software is a product and you buy it, and we don't tell you how to make it, and we don't let you make it, and property rules determine how it's used. And there were 25 years of strong contention on that subject, and we won, hands down, going away. There's nobody left who doesn't believe what we believed at the beginning, that software is made by sharing. Microsoft, the single greatest antagonist of that idea, surrendered and came over to the open source way of doing business, and even the king of the undead now dead, who hated sharing with a passion because it conflicted with his impulse to humiliate and destroy the human race, even the king of the undead now dead came around to our way of thinking because nobody could do it without. So, grudgingly and with constant attacks on the way in which our legal machinery worked and our rights distributions functioned, even Apple became an open source company to a significant degree. That was the one thing. The second thing that happened was that the idea of a crazy genius whom nobody remembered then or does remember now or will remember later, named Ted Nelson, came to occupy the role of the human, in the human race's role in the world, what Gutenberg did. Ted Nelson began in the late 1950s thinking about a thing he called hypertext, about the idea that computers could be networked together such that people could share information through text that included links, so that people could go back and forth in a structure of information that would put every document everywhere. Later, when a guy had made a bunch of money out of selling hamburgers by the side of the road, Ted decided that this would be the McDonald's of text. Everywhere there would be a thing on every corner where you could print every book and have it bound for you and hand it to you at minimum cost, and everything would be connected in an online universe in which everybody could go from book to book. And my comrade Richard Stallman wrote an article about the encyclopedia Everybody Can Edit, which explained how we should turn all of the technical ability to network our computers into an encyclopedia that the whole human race could make for itself and share, and everybody could do research and learning in that way. And over at CERN, where there were a ton of physicists breaking up the universe and looking at its fragments and trying to decide what that told us about its history, writing papers so fast that the journals couldn't publish them, a young English technologist who knew Ted Nelson's hypertext the way all of us in the counterculture knew it, we possessed copies of Ted's literary machines the way other people in 1870 or 1880 would have possessed copies of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. This young English technologist, Tim Berners-Lee, working at CERN, decides that in order to make it possible for CERN's physicists to publish papers faster, there should be a hypertext worldwide web of physics at CERN. And he wrote some free software code and stuck it into the world of Unix to make it possible for the physicists at CERN to publish internally and link to one another's work so that the whole knowledge base of the laboratory would be available to the lab all the time. That was less than 10,000 days ago. And everything about how you learn and live has changed since then. So if I'm to answer what it was that happened, I need to talk about that stuff. This other stuff, well, see, this is a consequence of the fact that we destroyed the Microsoft. What free software did was to turn the software that runs all those servers into a commodity with $0 unit price, right? Because we give everything away. So all kinds of technological patterns that were impossible, if you had to think of every computer as having to buy a Windows license, if the unit price of software is so high that it begins to absorb all the profit made by that hyper-productivity of the hardware builders, we have better and better and better hardware, and Windows just gets bigger and bigger and slower, and you have to keep upgrading the hardware, and you have to pay the unit cost of the upgrade. And that model determined how computers could work, because the high unit cost of software and the sucking up of all the hardware profit into the software monopoly did what monopoly is always doing in Eck 101. It reduced output and it decreased innovation. When we destroyed the unit pricing model of software licensing, when everything became available to share, when GNU and Linux and the World Wide Web all came into existence, people could imagine new forms of software's relationship to hardware, and therefore hardware's relationship to services, to the things people actually get, because there wasn't any paying for the unit cost of the computer anymore. Now you could build clusters where before you used to think in terms of supercomputers. You could think in terms of what will happen if we put 100,000 cheap computers in a place where the electricity is cheap, and then we generate services to give them to everybody else, and we don't have to pay for 100,000 fucking Windows licenses. So free software made these guys. It made it possible for them to create structures of centralized serving and storage, because the software was a commodity and the hardware got cheaper and faster and bigger and better all the time. And they got the growth of all of that. And the way they financed it was by spying on the users and selling information about them to the advertisers. That was the single business that did it all. Because 20th century advertising was about throwing spaghetti at the wall and hoping it stuck to a consumer. Put a beer commercial on television with some scantily clad female persons in it, and folks will buy beer, or at least some of them will. And we don't know who they are, but we buy the television advertisements anyway. And we have a bunch of people in New York who say they make very clever television advertisements, and we pay them a lot of money, but we never really know if it works. Once the network, once the web began to be a surveillance instrument for you, then advertising changed. Instead of being buying a bunch of billboards and hoping somebody who wants beer sees a beer commercial, it became, there's a box in which people type everything they're looking for. Why don't we just advertise to the people who already want what we're selling? Oh my God. The people who can do that, those are the alchemists, right? They can turn shit into gold. So they did. It's a pattern of technology. But the pattern of technology begins by noticing that it's extraordinarily profitable to watch you read and to hear you think. And so everything becomes a technological system for watching what you read and hearing what you think. Also, it gives you calendaring and email and et cetera, et cetera. But if you ask, where does it make the carbon dioxide? What is it burning the electricity over? Where is its money really being spent? Where is the investment? It's not in the expense of the services provided to the human beings. Those are cheap and trivial. It's in all that collecting and analyzing and running AdSense and all those other things. That's where the carbon dioxide comes from. That's where the electricity is used. Because software's free, hardware's cheap and inexhaustibly improving, human beings will do this. Let's go. All right? That's what changed. Is that a responsive answer? Okay. That's why we are now here. That's why everything is sitting in information dumps with little fences around them run by Google and Facebook, and why government can go and get it there without having to come to you for it. That's why the Fourth Amendment doesn't work. That's why the guys who have turned into publishers now control what we call freedom of speech. And it's why everybody wants you not to think about the fact that your reading is surveilled all the time. That the primary interference with freedom of thought isn't the censorship or non-censorship of what you write, it's the constant, unremitting surveillance of what you read. Most of it on a device which not only keeps track of what you're reading, but keeps track of your heartbeat while you're reading. And just in case that wasn't enough, there's a fitness bracelet collecting all the rest of it. That's what the technology turned into. That's how it came to be like that. But the most important thing is it doesn't have to be like that. Another future, indeed another past, is possible. We just have to know what it would be. Questions? No? Truly no? Good heavens. All right. So, but in this room, everybody is staring at a different screen. Day trading. One of the things that I like, this room, of course, is useless for all educational purposes. It has no good features at all. One of the things I like about the rooms on the west side where I teach most of the time is that I can actually walk around the room. And that's very instructive because I see what people's laptops are actually for. My favorite over the years was a student who used to be deeply involved in shopping for his future every class. So one day his laptop would be primarily engaged in looking at high-end real estate in Fairfield County, where he planned to live later. And another day he would be shopping for Lexuses, you know. But the day I liked the best, the one that really taught me a ton, was the day that this student of mine was shopping on his laptop in class for boarding schools for the kids he didn't have yet. You will all recognize this. I know it isn't you, but it's people sitting near you in law school, right? Okay. The critical thing about this form factor in computing is that unlike the smartphone, it wasn't primarily invented for the purpose of betraying you. The laptop you use doesn't specialize in collecting all your behavior and in notifying you in distressing ways designed to increase your engagement with the platforms. It's not optimized as a device for the parasite with the mind of God. It's not directly engineering generated for that purpose. And it contains, therefore, more hope. But it's also a complicated and uneasy object. As usual, it basically comes in two flavors, right? There's the walled paradise of the king of the undead now dead, beautiful in its construction, beautiful and compelling in its graphics and in its effort to reach your eye, important to your ear, because so much of the music production in the world came to be for, again, technically contingent reasons, centered around his objects. Therefore, thought of by people as a tool for creation, strongly enabled by the reality distortion field of the king of the undead, now dead, who created absolutely choiceless, you will take it the way I give it to you material, and advertised it under the rubric of think differently, using the faces of dead thinkers of difference to advertise his think differently conformist hell, but beautiful. And from a technical point of view, almost always cleanly working, right? It wasn't designed to remind you that computers are imperfect. The King of the Undead Now Dead always presented a perfect technological structure, and he liked it powerfully blank. The next, which was the most beautiful computer he ever built, the one with almost all of the best technical ideas in it that he ever had, and the only one in which he ever tried to coexist with the software ecologies that we believed in, the next was, as you may recall, a featureless black cube. It was stunning. Because he, like us, we were all kids at the same time. We saw 2001 when it was made, or rather when Kubrick released it. And we all had access then only to really low-quality marijuana compared to the existing materials, right? The hardware engineers have done very well there, too. So we were stoned at the level that people in our generation could be stoned when we saw 2001 for the first time. We were all thinking about how. We thought about how because we were afraid of the unintended consequences of technology, and the myth of how is the myth of the unintended technological consequences, which was like all the science fiction of our time, which was ultimately about nuclear war. It was the culture which brought us to the ideas I'm here trying to describe to you nearly 50 years later. But that wasn't what Steve saw. He saw the monolith. And everything that happened in his creative career, all the monstrosity and beauty of his art, is contained in that image of hubris. The monolith that made the ape men grow, but also controlled them, and also made man the terrorist, and man the speeder with all of that stuff. That's what enthralled Steve Jobs, and he built those. So that's one form of the laptop in front of you. One form of it is the monolith from 2001. Its job is to astound you, to awe you, to be insanely great, and to control you from the simplicity and elegance of its artistic design. Its power rests in its incomprehensibility. You can't get into the monolith. You'd need special tools, and you'd need to be an alien genius. That was what he took away while we were busy worrying about how they programmed Hal and where the glitch was and how the bug could have saved the lives, and etc. The other laptop in front of you is essentially a derivative of the Windows world, and I'm not now going to describe in detail what that was about, because you know already it wasn't about art. But still, fundamentally, what you have before you is a device which was meant, like all the computers that preceded it, to assist learning, to support the human intelligence, and which show the design consequences of an effort to establish power over people at the same time that it purports to help or assist them. And that power consists of an obscurity. One of the procession of Microsoft's CTOs under Gates and Ballmer said once in a speech, that the secret to the software industry is never show anyone the source code to anything. The same basic idea, that technology is powerful because you can't open it up and see what's going on in it. Directly antithetical to our idea that there are four freedoms in connection with programming. The right to run the program for any purpose, the right to have the source code to study it and understand how it works, the right to share with other people, and the right to modify, either for private use or for sharing. The other side of that idea, that software is an obscure unit, that you buy it as a product, that you run it in your laptop, that your laptop has a little seal on the bottom that says, I am an authorized Windows user, and here is the serial number of the Windows I am authorized to use, with a little hologram and all that stuff. Barbed wire that we hated, I mean, just revolted from in our souls, right? Anytime I buy a computer, I immediately scrape the Windows sticker off the bottom of it, facing all the horrible glue and all, just to get rid of the idea that my computer is licensed to me by anybody. But those are basically the two flavors of the endpoint that doesn't spy on you much. Mind you, every spotlight search you conduct on that macOS computer, it registers with the home ship what you were searching for. Mind you, you never really know what's going on because you can't see the operating system or how it's working. And if somebody has put something bad in there, and boy do they, you'll never find out. Because fundamentally the thing is still a tool licensed to you that does what the guy who made it wants you to be able to do with it. And if that's not what it's doing, then something went wrong and there should be legal redress somewhere on behalf of the manufacturer for it. Which means that although the laptop is not spying on you the way the phones are, upstream, all of these things are still in place, and the endpoint is not your lever with which to move the world. At best, it's a neuron that doesn't rat you out, and at worst, it's the spy satellite aimed at you. Our endpoints aren't very good. So far, so clear, you at least understand what I'm complaining about? All right. So let's imagine that we start cleaning up the network at that end. Which benefit are we trying to get?
Like communication and using it as an advertisement. You know.
Why do we want that? In all these years that we are talking about, in all that half century of my life with computers, never, ever, not once, ever, ever has an advertisement appeared on my computer. Why would I ever want advertisements on my computer? Imagine just for a moment that you have spent a long lifetime, done your 20, working with computers, and you have never, ever, ever seen or wished to see an advertisement on your screen. Why will such a person immediately think, oh my God, how do I get the benefit of advertising on my desktop? How do I get the benefit of advertising in the web? Why would such a person think that? So I stand here. I am such a person. Never, ever, 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 never, not once ever, has any computer of mine had the audacity to show me an advertisement. Why will I regard that as a benefit? Surely I will regard it as a bug. I will fix the bug that allows some other human being to use my computers to distort my thought process, my understanding of time, my cognitive rhythm, my ability to clear the deck and stare out the window at the sky and think. Why will I ever surrender to anybody the technological entitlement to disturb that process of thought. So to begin with, then, I need to ask whether we're allowed to reconsider that relationship between the computer and you. I say another future is possible. I say a future is possible, immediately accessible. I know, because I live there, there is another future in which your computers stop interrupting you. They stop notifying you. They stop bleeping and bitching and dancing and opening frames and animating and doing all those things, the purpose of which is to disturb the rhythm of your mental life in order to commoditize your attention. I say, technically, we don't have to do that. Are we allowed to ask that question? Is that other future's possibility relevant? What I took from your question is no, it's not relevant. We want all that stuff. How do we make sure we get it? So why would that be? Okay, so we're going to do that. I'm about to get there, but let me just say one thing before we get there. Of the 100 most visited destinations in the web, one out of 100, 99 are otherwise, one does not surveil the people who use it. Which one is it?
Wikipedia?
Sure. Communication, learning, yeah, of course. So what? The relationship between that and the parasite and the surveillance and the analytics and the collection of your behavior is zero. We know how to do the thing you're asking, communicate, learn, teach to everyone, change the life of every literate human being on the planet, make all research simpler and easier and faster and better. We know how to do all that without this other stuff. So where's the need for the other stuff? If we're not asking that question, we don't care whether there's an alternative. So I want to ask the question. Now, let's come to the thing you're really asking about. How can we make these endpoints do that job better? So, one of the things that Google wanted to do in the world was to provide a free operating system for the spy satellite in your pocket. Free in our sense, free is in freedom. You can read the source code of much of it anyway. And everybody could agree to develop it, and manufacturers could use it for zero, and the search box would lead to Google, right? That's what the Android proposition was. The Android proposition was, we can make free software for mobile spy devices. We can give it away to all the world's manufacturers. They will all use it. We will get the data. It was a beautiful play. Also, dependent upon our way of licensing software, Android can't work without free software licensing. There's about $3.27 trillion worth of annual commerce connected with the Android economy. Okay, free software is a very money-making proposition, which is why my practice has done well all these years. But that wasn't enough for Google. As I've explained, the Windows monopoly generated almost all the profit in the world of laptops and other small personal computers. The high unit price of operating systems sucked out pretty much all the profit. So if you made a $1,000 laptop on Intel hardware for Windows, it was a struggle to make a profit on it. And lots of companies, including, for example, IBM, realized that they couldn't. The IBM idea in the era of the personal computer, when the IBM PC was new, and all the way through into the ThinkPad era, the IBM business proposition was to be the world's least cost producer of small computers. It failed, of course. They couldn't be. Ultimately, that's why they sold the laptop business to Lenovo. So, the question for the manufacturers of small computers was how to make them profitable again if Windows always sucked up all the available profit in the machines. This is what Google was attacking when it made Chromebooks. On the laptop side, what Google did was not to make free software that would run in people's smartphones, but instead to make hardware designs that would run their cloud-based operating system. So all the software came from them, and all the software used Google for storage and intermediary and servicing. And that meant that if your Chromebook got destroyed, it wouldn't matter. You could simply log in on another Chromebook to your Google account, and it would download all the relevant data, and you would be fine, and nothing would ever get lost. And because it's not Windows, boy, is it easy to make good hardware cheap. So what the Chromebook became for the manufacturers of the world was really, really profitable, cheap stuff you could make fast. Sell lots of. This particular one I'm holding, when Acer made it, it was a $300 computer. And unlike the $1,000 Windows computer on which they could barely make a profit, this was a $300 dual-core laptop that everything had been spec'd from Google, just works great, runs Chrome terrific, and they could make $100 profit on a $300 object. It was astoundingly good. Because now what the platform was doing was taking advantage of all that wonderful hardware engineering and all that extraordinary engineering of hardware development over decades, and they were reversing the economic structure by depriving the software monopolist of the ability to gobble up all the gains from innovation. Of course, the Chromebook has to run Chrome. Sort of. Because Chrome, like Android 2, is based on free software, and there are rules. We make licensing rules, rules about sharing. So Google never actually designed or had any manufacturer build a Chromebook that was as tied to Chrome as Windows computers were tied to Windows, or much less, as Mac OS Xboxes were tied to the operating system of Apple. Steve actually used very complicated digital barbed wire to keep Mac OS from running on any other hardware. No more experiments with Apple-compatible hardware ever again. But the Google designs for Chromebooks are extremely forgiving of the fact that there are those of us in the world who don't want to run their fucking operating system. This one, if you want to evict Chrome from it, you undo one screw, and you put one little ball of tin foil in one jumper, and you run one little piece of code, and that's it. It's not a Chromebook anymore. I did all this work in order to have disposable computers. My goal in originally doing this engineering was simply to have computers that could be taken to China and left there. The situation of, what shall we call it, aggressive, active listening to technological development, which was a big part of the Chinese way of doing business all the way along, left a whole lot of Americans bringing laptops to China and then bringing them home again, and then IT supposedly did this, that, or the other thing to clean them, and they were compromised forever. And so originally I started doing this engineering because what I wanted was a thing I could cheaply take on a business trip and leave in the hotel wastebasket on the way out of the country. And that brought us to the effort to de-chrome the Chromebooks. But that was just the reason that we did the work, not what the work ultimately enabled. So okay, so here is a laptop. I bought 36 of this particular model of Chromebook because I liked it for various engineering reasons. And on the average, over the three dozen that I bought, I paid an average of $81.50 each. Disposable laptops. Cheap enough that anybody in the world could use them and dispose of them. Really, really good. Wonderful engineering. Immense power. No cost. Now, the thing about this particular one, and this is why I want to talk about this in relation to endpoint design, is that this computer, as it sits here right now, has no software in it at all. It's an empty box. The hardware is completely dissociated from the software. If this were opened by a policeman or a border guard or a spy or just a curious, technologically sophisticated 12-year-old, I mean, it's a magician's box. It's completely empty. Look here, okay? I open every lid. There's not a bit in it anywhere. It works real well. We could start it up right now. We could decide which of 8 or 10 operating systems and configurations and systems designs we wanted to run. This is my keychain of operating systems, right? The ones I personally need. The ones that are authorized to access my network at home, the ones that are authorized to access my law practice, the ones that aren't authorized to access anything, the ones that are just default systems made from freshly installed software without so much as an Eben account on them, only guest. And as you understand, I mean, these little USB keys, they're fully encrypted. If somebody wants to steal these from me and analyze them now, good luck to them. Even if they're the NSA and they have quantum computing available, it will take them longer than they have to spend. Plugged in here, suddenly the laptop is doing whatever it is it's supposed to do. Being my personal workstation with all my data on it, being an empty vanilla system that nobody can track back to me, whatever it is, it's sitting on a disposable piece of storage, and it works in an empty laptop. Now, suppose for a moment that I do fire up any one of these systems at any level of security on this laptop, and I use it for a day on untrusted networks. Maybe somebody breaks in. Good for them. Because at the end of the day, those bits are going to be destroyed. I'm never going to run those bits again. They're just, the USB is going to be overwritten with a fresh copy. No bits will ever run twice. No attacker has any attack surface to modify because the surface will be destroyed. The system that was running will never run again. I told you last Wednesday, before we were here together, I did a talk at 7:30 in the morning at IIT Bombay. So at their early evening, I was giving a talk, and God help me, they required Zoom, okay, which, as you know, I refuse to use. So I Zoomed this talk in Bombay, and that means that I used a browser, not even a Zoom app, which I wouldn't run in 100,000 years, but just an in-browser Zoom conversation. And at the end of that hour and a half, that computer ceased to exist. My law partner said, oh, it seems you're still logged in over there in Bombay as her panel that succeeded mine started up. I said, yeah, that's just because Zoom doesn't bother to know that I've left already because I didn't hit the leave button. So it still thinks I'm there, but I need to tell you that for all practical purposes, the computer I was talking over 5 minutes ago has been destroyed. Why? Because I removed the USB key from a box, which was now empty again, and took it over to another computer and overwrote those bits. Whatever was done during that Zoom call to that computer ceased to be important because the computer had, or at least its software stack, had been destroyed. So let's imagine for a moment that instead of the laptop you currently use, the second device, the one that you think of as being a part of your active learning and academic understanding and professional practice and all of that, let's suppose for a moment that you no longer have an attackable device. It's not just that NSO spyware can't climb inside your smart-ass phone and live there for a year or two stealing everything without your knowing anything about it. It's also that Apple's not getting any of your behavior data, and Microsoft's not getting any of your behavior data, and Google's not getting any of your behavior data, and the hackers have nothing they can break in and steal, and there's no way to compromise your credentials, etc., 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 etc. You have actually a secure, high-quality endpoint. It actually costs you nothing. Because after all, this hardware is completely inexpensive. $81.70. So how many of those could I have had for the cost of one Mac OS X? Oh, yeah. Oh, shit. Not 10? It's an order. It's more than an order of magnitude less expensive? An order of magnitude? Those monoliths, man, they're really expensive, okay? One of the reasons I like this one is in order to get its cover off and do whatever I need to do inside, I have to remove one screw with an ordinary Phillips head, okay? The King of the Undead Now Dead wants you to have to go to geniuses in the basement of a temple with special tools and, to get the screws out. Because Kubrick taught him. That's what makes the ape man grow, okay? Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. All right, that's an endpoint. If we secure the endpoint, if we make it impossible for people to use the endpoint as the way they get into you, we've done one good thing. Now let's get over here. Here the problem is that the networks are also behavior collectors. Just the telecoms providers, right? You're a student, you live on the Columbia University campus or anywhere where our network reaches. You can get an Ethernet drop and at least 100 megabits per second bidirectional service in your apartment. It will cost you $29 a month. I have to pay the faculty price, which is $40. If I run a small business in an office building on 69th Street and Broadway, which I did for 17 years, then my business internet service will be roughly 25 times that for less good service. And if I'm a working class person living in Harlem with a smart-ass phone that I got from Verizon or from AT&T and I have a data plan, I'm going to pay three orders of magnitude more at the top end just to have connectivity than it costs you or me in the Columbia network that socialism gives us. But in addition to that, you can't trust it because it's busy collecting behavior and inserting advertisements into the stream based on the telco's knowledge of your behavior. And once again, all of that is supposed to remind you only that you're receiving advertisements, but not that everything you're reading or touching is being surveilled. But if you build for telcos, so I was in Shenzhen in 2010, touring Huawei Skunk Works, looking at stuff they are making or will make that they are proud of, as they should be. And one of the devices that they are making and that they are proud of is a beige box about the size of a dorm refrigerator, and that sits on a nicely tuliped pedestal, and it's all made to look like the sort of utility box you would see on any suburban street corner in the United States. And I say, so what is that? And they say, oh, that is our telecommunications carrier neighborhood profit optimizer. And I say, really? how does it work? And they say, well, look here. And they have a mock-up of an entire little suburban cul-de-sac. And over here in this house, in this bedroom up there, is Billy. And he is watching television he got off the BitTorrents. And what we want to do is slow him down. And over here in this living room, in this other house, is people watching pay-per-view movies or fistfights. And we want to speed them up and charge them extra, and etc. All around all the houses in this cul-de-sac, this little box is sitting on the corner optimizing the telco revenue moment by moment, hour by hour, by messing with what we came later to call network neutrality, a confusing set of words dreamed up by a telco executive and put like an earwig into the ear of one of my lesser colleagues. So this, the anti-network neutrality telco profit optimization box, is an example of the networks, they themselves, and what it is that we wish to avoid with them. So what can we do about that inside our now secure endpoint? If you're a business, you have branch offices where people have desktops, laptops, tablets, etc., and they connect to other branch offices with all of that, and they connect to home offices with data warehouses that are enormous, and a business's network incorporates all these segments, which they may very well be using over public networks. They too buy their connectivity from telcos, and they get their networking management from network management companies and all that. But they run software in all of these devices, all the routers in their corporate networks, that encrypt all that traffic, and that make it appear that all these different networks to which they are attached is one great big network of their own, in which their security is layered on top of all the public networking. They have virtual private networking. That's what this acronym actually means. It means the use of network software to layer secure communications on top of unsecured communications to give the impression that the whole of an organization's network is inside one private secured structure. That's the actual meaning of VPNs. Every business in the world of any size uses them. Cisco boxes, VPN concentrators, and other secure network plumbing have made great big profits for all of that is what ordinary human beings do not have. But there's no real reason they do not have them. There's nothing that requires expensive hardware. It's just software, and it can run inside anything. These things, actual virtual private network software, is simply like everything else, free software commodities. Human beings, ordinary users, aren't taught how, aren't taught when, aren't enabled, don't expect the operating systems made by Google and Apple to be particularly helpful. Even the word has been turned into something completely different. You remember what it's turned into. You have an endpoint. You wish to get to the World Wide Web. The best way to do that is to open an encrypted channel between you and some intermediary called a proxy. The proxy then browses the World Wide Web and passes everything that comes back to your browser over the encrypted channel. That's what ordinary consumers now call a VPN. It's not a VPN. It's secure proxy browsing. It's really good. Very helpful. I should be teaching you right today how to use it using Columbia computers you can use for free, except they broke it, and I'm still fighting. Very useful, very nice, very helpful, not a VPN. You should have one. All your devices should be connected in a way which allows you to see one whole and secure network. Your house, your objects in your house, your object in your pocket, the laptop in your pocket, in your bag, all of it should be capable of communicating securely with any other computer of yours or which you are prepared ultimately to trust, and nobody should be able to listen. And under those circumstances, the providers of interconnection don't get anything of yours. They just don't. All they see is a bunch of packets they cannot understand. They cannot optimize. They cannot spy upon. They're just out. You're in a world of zero trust networking. Hard? No, it's not hard. In fact, under ordinary circumstances, with the right software running in your devices, it's invisible to you. You just see the network. It so happens that the part of the network you are usually addressing is secured by you and obscure to all other parties. Maintains your secrecy, conceals your location, makes it impossible for people to collect behavior out of the air in between your endpoints and the platforms. Now we have secured that part of the network. Questions? All right, so we're still working our way outward. Now we have reached a place where your storage is. For all practical purposes, these things are your web servers, right? They provide for the ability that you have to send out things like status updates and other absolutely imperishable material, your blog posts, your video taken of cops doing the wrong thing in the wrong place at the right time. The live streaming, the conferencing, all of it is occurring over here. And it's pretty convenient in the sense that it works. And the cost is it spies on you all the time. All the time. All the time. Everything you read, everything you touch, everything you click upon, everything you don't click upon, swiping left, swiping right, all being remembered forever by everybody. Well, I don't mean by everybody, I mean by a few people. Could we attack that? What would we have to do? This is the subject of my Freedom in the Cloud talk from 2009. This is what led me to say 12 years ago that this monster, Mark Zuckerberg, had done more harm to the human race than anybody else his age. In 2009, this was a controversial statement. In 2021, it's become kind of normal. Because everybody figured out that this place is not a place in which to allow somebody with an unlimited desire to listen to behavior. The cloud here means we have a bunch of large computers which consume vast amounts of electricity, and we use those large computers to move work processes and data around the world to wherever the electricity is cheapest at the moment. And we move capacity around to reduce our costs of operation, including all these costs of surveillance, which are high overhead. And we move all that around from place to place because the cloud means that we can move the contents of computers, the software stacks, frictionlessly from one physical computer to another, as I am doing here with this box. They can do with large collections and all the various operations necessary to maintain a database keeping track of the behavior of 2 billion people. Can be spread up around the world, and it can be moving from one location to another, thus evading government rules, but also moving where the electricity is cheapest, which is the really important point. But let's just go back for a moment to the way it looks to you as an individual instead of to them. You need some stuff. But the stuff you need is services. There's a service called email. There's a service called calendar. There's a service called MediaStream. There's a service called Dropbox, or Sync, or Backup, or Photos, etc., etc. Services, individual services. Things you expect that from a computer under your control, you can get from some centralized location that stores and keeps safe. But by centralized, you don't need to mean with everybody else. You just mean centralized compared to your cloud of devices, your camera and your printer and your this and your that. That anybody else is getting to any of these things should only be a matter of your having given permission. It shouldn't be a matter of any operator having taken permission. All we would really need to do is to explain to you how you could have a server on the net that would do all these things for you, but wouldn't rat you out anywhere and wouldn't store your data with anybody else. And what we would really like to do would be to make that so easy for you as a human being that you wouldn't really have to do anything except plug it in and forget about it. Back then, in the Pleistocene we were talking about, we had things called telephone answering machines, too. We took them into our houses and we plugged them into the telephone in the wall and we forgot about them and they did the work. So what would it take to take all that stuff that produces all the services you want and that you need from day to day and to deliver them to you in a network that was differently configured? The answer is it wouldn't take anything very much. You'd need hardware. But hardware costs nothing and is wonderful. And you need some software, and software is free. I meant to bring an actual Freedom Box, the one in my office, the one with the little symbol on it and with the little metal, sheet metal bent around it and all of that, but I forgot. And so I can only use a current one, a really good one, this one. That happens to be a Pine 64 board. It happens to be manufactured in China out of Chinese material and a Chinese chip and all the best of the current cheap hardware engineering in the world. That one costs about $70. And if I take the chip that is in here with the Freedom Box stack in it and I plug it into that and I plug it into power and the wall, I'm done. What software runs in there? Well, of course, it could be a real VPN concentrator and some real proxy browsing and some effort to clean the malware and the advertisements out of your browsing stream even as you're browsing because it's the router in the way and it can take care of stuff that it sees going by that isn't any good. And it could have a BitTorrent client in it which could be collecting your homework from your school district, or it could be collecting your music or movies from sharing in the world, or but it could be doing all those things. And it could be media streaming to your handset over your VPN so nobody would know what you're listening or watching. And among other things, it could be running some nice free software which happens to be called Nextcloud. Look at nextcloud.com if you happen to want to, which would be capable of doing all these things: email, calendaring, notifications, dashboard, sync, backup, media streaming, running your media collection, all that stuff. And instead of using Google as the back end, or Ali as the back end, or Tencent as the back end, instead of using a public cloud, you have your own. And the server is, well, I mean, you see, it's not going to take a lot of electricity. In fact, you could run it on a pair of AA batteries if you wanted to. And wherever it's connected in the net, it knows how to back itself up to a freedom box that belongs to your friends. And if you ever had a breakage, if it broke, if it died, you'd throw it away and get another empty one and plug it in, and it would rebuild itself from the copies that it had encryptedly left on your friends' freedom boxes, and you'd be back in business. And there isn't any Google anymore. And there isn't any Twitter anymore. And Zoom? Really? You think? I run, because I won't use video conferencing for teaching, I don't need a big heavyweight video conferencing installation, but I use, as some of you have worked with me before know, I used in the epidemic a little Jitsi Meet video conference server to run groups up to about 10 people, office hours, special section meetings, and all that sort of stuff. The Jitsi Meet server that I use isn't in an SBC like a Freedom Box. It's in a virtual machine that sits in one of the boxes in my office, which is deliberately crippled. I run that instance of Jitsi Meet on a tiny little VM in my office, which has less main memory than that board does, and which has no writable disk at all, so that it could never save a video conference even if it wanted to, because it has no storage to save it in. And I run that VM that way precisely because that's the one that we will put in the next version of the Freedom Box software. A Zoom that belongs to you, in which you own the server, in which nothing can ever be saved because there's nothing to write, and it's using minimum storage, and still you can host a 10 or 12 person conference on it. So there goes Zoom. Do you know what Columbia University pays for each of you to use Zoom each term, by any chance? Does that number happen to get out to you? Columbia University is presently paying Zoom $15 a seat per term. $15 a seat. I mean, you know, again, it's sort of like the $1,200 Mac Air, right? Or the or the data plan sold to your working class neighbors here in Harlem. It's just outrageous. It's just theft. But the theft of the money comes along with the theft of the behavior, all of which is completely unnecessary. The way of engineering the technology to use the cheapest of computers in the most widespread of hardware configurations, all hitched together through true VPNs that the intermediaries can't see and can't read, offering the services that the platforms offer under your control without spying or behavior collection of any kind, using endpoints that cost nearly nothing and are actually secure. Freedom begins by knowing that another future is possible. Technological analysis of the reason that our rights are threatened in the era of the net involves an understanding of the ways in which technology has been designed either not to further freedom or deliberately to interfere with freedom for commercial or governmental benefit. The goal in the technological analysis of all these issues is to locate what the current technology patterns are that support the behavior you do not want, and to take advantage of the existence of alternate technologies in order to support the behavior that you do. And that can be altered on a person-by-person, household-by-household basis. I used to work with an extraordinarily capable engineer who had spent his career at Qualcomm. His fundamental job, because Qualcomm is fundamentally a patents company, His fundamental job was providing the technological analysis that supported Qualcomm's efforts to avoid other people's infringement claims. So his job was really understanding Qualcomm's tech and knowing how to argue around other people's patents. And he was very, 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 very good at this job. I would have said among all the people I knew in the industry who did this work that he was the best. And he had, Qualcomm guys, the persons, making a lot of money in Southern California. They like fancy cars, and they like big fancy home tech in their big fancy houses. That's part of what being workers, professionals like them is about. And he had a really, 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 really good Apple home. Apple everything. And then Qualcomm got into a nuclear war with Apple. And the patent fighting got really, really nasty. And, it was one of the nastiest parts of the great smartphone patent. And it's still ringing, even though they have a 2-year truce in pretty good effect. And when Apple went to war with Qualcomm, Roger was really pissed because they had become the enemy over there at the King of the Undead Now Dead. And he had to rip out his Apple house. And I happened to be passing through San Diego for whatever another reason, and we happened to be in some high-level meeting or other chatting before it went on. And he was saying that he had just had to pull all the Apple gear out of his house. And, of course, he had replaced it all with Android and Google and Nest and tens of thousands of dollars of effort to decontaminate himself from the now enemy company's tech. And he said to me, and the thing that's really worrying me is that I know that one day Google is going to do something terribly, terribly horrible to Qualcomm. And what will I do then? And I said, Roger, that's when you become a free software activist and you convert to Freedom Box. It hasn't happened yet, but it's guaranteed to occur. He's right. In the course of time, that technology pattern, too, will become hostile to his own perceived needs, identified loyally to his company, although he has subsequently left Qualcomm. That technology pattern will begin to read unfree to him, the way the Apple tech did once Apple was attacking his team. Up until that time, it hadn't worried him. He was a great Southern California libertarian. As long as government wasn't doing it, he didn't care about it. Then he did. Then he didn't. Then he will. Freedom it begins in knowing that another future is possible. Possible. And by possible, what we mean in my side of the movement is what we always meant. Proof of concept plus running code. We know it can be done because we have it here. It works. Because it supports our lives. Because it keeps the advertisements off all my computers and out of my network. Because I know that whatever my mind wishes by way of the network, my network will adapt to my mind, not the other way around. And because I know that nobody is raising the average temperature on the surface of the earth in order to analyze information they got from behavior they collected from me. All analysis should now begin from the recognition that that's possible. Then the question becomes, what do you want? And to get all Vladimir Ilyich Lenin about it, what is to be done? There are office hours now if you happen to want to talk about any of this. Otherwise, have a nice week. See you next Thursday. Look out for your edited drafts.